Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Mlynn, joined by Jack Spencer, Simon Schuster, Abigail Walls, and Jacob Kanzler. Yes, I am playing the Michigan State fight song, and yes, I understand that things are not probably going to go all that well this weekend, but I have to just out of sheer pride, and we're going to do our predictions a little later and be a little depressing, but you know what's really interesting, Jack? As I look around here, the margin here of State and U of M fans has shrank. Now it's just kind of, it's 3-2 in this room right now with you and Walls as the two.
For years here, I was really a blue island in the sea of green for a long time. And we had a little bit of a switch and a little bit of a change in personnel. And I wasn't quite so alone, which gave me somebody to talk to quietly under, you know, whenever the other people left the room.
I still can't believe we haven't done something, Jacob, about that Michigan lunch pail in the fridge. Something's got to be done with that. Can we put some like green tape on that or something?
Yeah, and it was in here before Abby was even in here. So I'm wondering why it has like permanent residence in the refrigerator.
Yeah, I know it. I know it. She hadn't shown up yet, and it was still in there. I think she's trying to bait us or something.
I should also like to point out though that while the fandom is now somewhat evenly split, the number of alumni are not.
No, that is very true. And John is not here, and that would tip it to 4-2.
My goodness, guys. I mean, if truth be told, if Albion had a football team worth talking about, that's what I'd be talking about. I'm sorry, I grew up in a U of M family.
Yeah, all right. Well, so did I, but I converted. Well,
can we all disagree on Western Michigan? They got a giant billboard that's proclaiming them undefeated on 96 just past Okemos, so.
Fight on for Western.
Hey, that's our fight song in Albion, Fight On.
Well, somebody copied somebody.
Probably. We're gonna have to do some research. Because it's Western, I'm going to guess they copied us.
Okay. Well, we'll have the research staff figure that one out. Or if one of our listeners would like to clear up this, whose fight song came first, Albion or Western Michigan? And maybe if we remember, we'll talk about that next week. Okay. Let's talk about the final 2 weeks of the presidential campaign. Probably couldn't come any sooner, really, for all of us. Jack, is there anything that either of the candidates on the Republicans, Democrats, or even local candidates can do to really make a huge splash or a dent this close to the election?
Well, they're going to all work to try to do the best they can, but the simple answer is probably not. It's in a situation with the last 2 weeks where it usually takes some act of God or something happening that's beyond the control of either campaign if it's going to make any kind of a splash in the last 2 weeks.
And why is that, guys? I mean, it would seem like if you had like some really breaking news on somebody or you had some real good dirt, that you drop it like the day before the election or a week before the election, in this case 2 weeks. But you're right, it never really seems to work, even in local races.
I mean, it's the seven times rule. Even if everybody turned on their TVs or their radios for the morning broadcast, they still wouldn't see it enough times to really have the density to move voters. I think the thing that we've seen in previous elections that actually moves people is when the mistake comes out of the candidate's mouth themselves. Yeah, it's pretty undeniable. I'm thinking of Romney with the 47%. I'm thinking of, you know, even this NBC hot mic tape with Trump. That had a lot of legs because it came right out of his mouth.
And that came far enough away. It came close to a presidential debate. There was still a little fluidity in the minds of voters as to where they were going to go. I think people's minds are kind of made up and they're ready to go, Jacob.
I feel like a lot of what you need to know about the candidates is out there, both the bad and the good. And again, like Jackson, unless something crazy comes up, either for Trump or for Clinton, you know, I think people have a good idea of what they like and they don't like. And I think what Abby said in terms of getting that out, getting the message out, that's what takes the time to do it. So I think you have that working against you.
And I think we saw that this weekend, Simon, with Trump doing his last pitch, even though we've got like, what, 10 days left to go for the
election? Yeah, I mean, he gave a speech recently which was supposed to represent the closing arguments of his campaign. And I think part of the problem for Donald Trump as a candidate is that he when he's in these rallies and people are cheering for him and applauding him, he's treating it like a focus group of undecided voters, when in fact it's not. And so when you're trying to make the closing arguments on, you know, your policy platform that's going to get you elected to the president of the United States, you shouldn't be defending yourself against sexual assault allegations from women. He's far too willing to engage them. And so I think in these last 2 weeks, what you're going to see is every down-ballot Republican wrapping off a tourniquet on the top of the ticket.
For voters turning off their TVs thinking, oh my God, I've had enough, can we vote already? And that's just not on this race, but it's also on down-ballot races.
I think voters actually have learned or sense that if it's late in the race, down to that last week, that last 10 days, just, you know, discount it. It just, I think voters are smart enough to say, listen, anybody can throw anything on the wall at the last minute, knowing that there's not enough time for the other side to really dispute it or to really prove it wrong. And I think a lot of times, first of all, at that point, you have very few undecideds left anyway. But I think the problem you have changing things late in a race is that people just turn their ears off and figure out, okay, look, nothing. I'm not going to believe anything I hear in the last 10 days or the last 2 weeks.
Well, changing gears here, one of the last things I want to talk about here, going into lame duck, an issue that I think we're going to be wanting to pay attention to has to do with Uber and the Uber regulations that are currently going through the Senate right now. There is a very concentrated effort to finally get some regulations on Uber, Lyft, and these ride-sharing companies. Currently, they are unregulated in this state, as you've reported before, Jacob. The Department of Transportation actually had a cease and desist order on them. What was that, 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, they technically don't comply with the letter of the law, according to the Department of Transportation. Obviously, Uber has a different idea of that, but MDOT and you know, really any other authority doesn't really have the teeth to enforce that. So that's kind of why that's in front of the legislature right now.
And so Uber would really like to get this taken care of, but they were just in committee this past week. Senator Arlen Meekoff's team was putting together a compromise with the taxi cabs, the limo, the insurance companies, and Uber. They came out with a compromise. They threw it in front of the Senate committee, and the Senate committee said, hey, wait a minute here. We've got some other issues in regards to how the Detroit Metro Airport works into this. What do the background checks look like? Do we have the type of insurance? You guys say the insurance is taken care of, but are the riders in the actual vehicles going to be covered if something happens with the vehicle that they're in, that their insurance has to pick them up as opposed to the vehicle itself being covered? A lot of questions here, and I think that this is going to be one of those lame duck issues that may not get a lot of attention or get a lot of ink, but I think this is going to be a tough one for folks to deal with and something to keep an eye on in the last few days.
Joining us on the other end of the line is the CEO of Strategic National. He is John Yab. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks, Kyle.
Did you bring home any kind of souvenir from the Cubs' historic win on Saturday?
Sure. I've got a little towel, I've got a sweatshirt, and I've got a couple of hats.
And, of course, you got the memory in the Facebook video you took after the Cubs clinched their first World Series in what, since 40-something?
Yeah, I think it was the first since 45 in terms of going to the World Series.
Right, and that was the year they lost the Tigers, if I remember right.
I think that might be right. It was a very exciting weekend in Chicago. I don't have quite the energy I did 20 years ago, but we still managed to have a good time.
Well, I'm sure, and I'm not going to tell you how much you paid for the tickets to that thing, because I'm sure it cost a small fortune. But you're back in Grand Rapids now, and you have been doing a little bit of polling here this election cycle. And the reason I had you on is because I wanted to talk to you about the changes of the polls that we've seen in Michigan. I thought it was extremely striking that last week we had two polls on the presidential race. Mitchell Research and Communications had the race as a 13-point Hillary Clinton advantage in this state. And at the end of the week, Marketing Resource Group had the race at 5 points. Why would we see such a drastic change?
Well, I'd like to sort of take a step back to answer that question. You know, when you're polling any race, you make certain judgments about the makeup of the electorate that you're trying to poll. So, you know, 20 years ago, pollsters largely just did random digit dialing, where a computer would just randomly dial digits, and then as you got people on the phone, you would ask them polling questions. Then over time, existing data became a more dominant variable in that process. And so pollsters would say, okay, we're going to poll people who have voted in two of the last four general elections, or three of the last four general elections, or even four of the last four general elections if you thought turnout was going to be low. But there are certain elections that take place where the electorate changes. So, you know, in 2008, obviously the Democrats did a great job in turning out non-traditional African-American voters. in 2010. Our party did a great job in turning out some non-traditional voters that became known as sort of the Tea Party wave. If you go back to the year 2000, John McCain did a good job of turning out non-traditional voters into a Republican primary in the presidential primary that year. And then in 2010 here in Michigan, obviously we had a lot of independents and even some Democrats voting in the Republican primary. So occasionally there is a non-traditional surge in a portion of the electorate that doesn't traditionally vote either in a primary election or even in a general election. And how you handle those things in a poll is very, very important. So it's not that any pollster, Republican or Democrat, has a bias in terms of, oh, they're going to rig the results of this poll to show something. I don't believe that happens very much, if at all. But what does happen, generally speaking, is that every pollster makes certain judgments about what they think the electorate is going to be like, and therefore puts a sample into their system that is generally based on those assumptions that they make. And so whenever you look at any pollster's poll, you're somewhat trusting the assumptions they make of the turnout model. There's other ways to adjust for that in terms of doing your likely voter screen and whatnot, but there also is somewhat of a bias in terms of the data that you initially put in. And bias is too strong of a word. It's more a judgment on the likely turnout. In this particular cycle, you're finding what we call zero of fours, people who have not voted in any of the last four general elections, but are turning out to vote for Trump in the primary phase of the campaign. And there's a lot of data to show that they may very well turn out in the general election. Now, whenever you bet on voters who traditionally haven't turned out, you're, by definition, betting on something that doesn't usually happen. That said, there is a lot of data to show that the zero fours are going to turn out to vote, especially in rural areas, and are going to vote for Donald Trump. So how pollsters manage those non-traditional voters potentially coming into our electorate is largely to credited to the wide differentials you've seen a lot of polling across the country.
So when you're doing polling, and I know that you do polling, how much of this zero of the last four elections population do you put in your polling sample?
When I do polling for my own purposes, I don't really care too much about what the head-to-head shows. I mean, that's sort of an interesting thing, and if we're going to put something out publicly, then obviously we do that. But to be honest with you, it's not a big factor in what I'm looking at when I'm looking at the data. I would much rather drill down really far on only zero of fours and see whether they're going to turn out and how we turn them out, or even one of fours, you know, whether they're going to turn out and how we're going to turn them out. So when I'm doing polling for my own purposes, it's much more looking deeper at the data and pulling larger subsamples than it is, oh, let's get a sample of 400 and see where the race stands. So that's the short answer to that question. The short answer to the question, Kyle, is that it depends on what assumptions I'm making. And usually what I'll do is I'll drill down far on those 0-4 voters. And if it looks like they're going to turn out, then I go ahead and include them in the initial sample, and then the initial sample that's asked. And then we ask them the question. You know, you ask the likely voter questions and see whether they're planning on participating or not. But if you're a pollster that never inputs the zero of fours in the first place into your potential sample, then you're essentially never giving those people the opportunity to respond to your survey.
So let me ask you this question then. Do you think Trump is down double digits in Michigan based on everything you've just said?
No, I don't think he's down double digits. I'm not going to sit here and say that I think Trump is going to win Michigan. I think he has a better chance of winning Michigan than most political analysts give him credit for. I also think that there's a very high probability that you see a surprise somewhere in the country. So whenever there's a change in the electorate, there's automatically surprises that occur because the electorate has changed. I believe the electorate will be different this time than it was in 2012, than it was in 2008. It'll probably be more different than it's been maybe any time since I've been participating in politics. But certainly, you know, with possible exception of African-American turnout in 2008, but it's going to be a different electorate this time. You know, I think there will be some downward pressure on sort of moderate Republican areas, soccer mom sort of areas that we used to talk about 5-6 years ago. But I think there's going to be fairly substantial upward pressure on turnout in more rural areas of, say, northern Michigan, western Pennsylvania, and eastern Ohio.
Now, what do you think the impact is going to be down ballot? Because when we've done our polling, we've seen very little evidence of coattails. Have you seen any?
That's the best question there is. You know, it's going to be interesting because a new Trump voter who, say, is in a rural county who doesn't necessarily consider themselves a loyal Republican, but is inspired by Trump's message, will come out to vote. I believe there will be a fairly substantial number of those folks voting. And then the question becomes, okay, now when they're there, do they just vote Trump and leave, or do they continue voting down ballot? And I think, frankly, that remains to be seen, and I think that's the secret to this cycle is, will those Trump voters vote the rest of the ticket, and will they more than make up for any other losses that occur because of the unique nature of this cycle, or will they not turn out and vote?
Right.
And in those down ballot races.
And you know what? That's an interesting point you make there, because when I hosted a forum for the League of Women Voters in the 7th Congressional District, and I asked Gretchen Driscoll, for example, what she thought of Donald Trump, she did not necessarily just go off on him. She was very complimentary in some areas of his campaign, as if she has already been kind of programmed not to offend people who are voting for Donald Trump. And I wonder if in these competitive districts, that is a strategy that folks on both sides of the aisle are using. You don't necessarily want to defend him on everything he says, but you don't want to go ahead and offend people who are voting for Trump either.
That's right. I mean, I haven't seen too many polls that showed Trump losing independents. So if you assume that independents are an important factor in you winning in a given district, and you are targeting independent voters because you already have your party behind you, then insulting the candidate that independent voters like the most probably is not the wisest of actions.
We're just about 2 weeks away from Election Day. Any closing predictions on what you think is going to happen based on what you've seen?
No, I think there's going to be a lot of surprises. I think it's not going to be a traditional, what I call a BC04, Bush 2004 campaign. I look to BC04 as sort of the gold standard of how to run a normal, traditional Republican base turnout campaign. Sort of, you know, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, checking the boxes, moving the ball forward, much like Bo Schembechler would in running the ball, or Woody Hayes. And so, you know, this isn't going to be a BC04 campaign. This is a far different campaign that isn't based on turning out the traditional electorate. It's based on remaking the electorate. And so I think you're going to see a lot of surprises that happen, not just in Michigan and in legislative races, but across the country. I think you're going to be surprised by some of the candidates who win. I think you're going to be surprised by some of the candidates to lose, and I'm not sure it'll be a wave one direction or the other by party. You know, you had these wave elections in 2010 and 1994, but I'm not sure you're looking at a wave direction, a wave election either way. I think you're more looking at an election that will have a lot of surprises because of the change in the electorate rather than the dramatic victory of one side or the other.
It's John Yab. He is the CEO of Strategic National based in Grand Rapids. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, John. Joining us now on the podcast is the senator from the Kalamazoo area. She is Senator Margaret O'Brien. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So while myself and the boss, John Roerink, and others get tortured at Spartan Stadium watching a revived Michigan team try and get some revenge on Michigan State, you are going to be about 1,000 miles away.
I will. I'll be in Washington, D.C. Senator Knezik and I are getting ready for the Marine Corps Marathon.
Wow. Now, that is very exciting. You said yourself and Senator Knezik.
Yes. You know, we decided with us being the chair and vice chair of the Senate Veterans Committee that we wanted to join force just to show unified force that it doesn't matter what party you're from, we all stand here and support veterans. And we thought, what better way to do it than to do something hard, which is run a marathon.
And that is very hard. I can attest to that, having done it 2 weeks ago now. Now, you have run before, haven't you?
I have, but it's been 17 years since I ran a full marathon.
Wow. And obviously that takes a lot of training and so forth. So talk about that and why you guys decided to do this particular marathon.
Well, Senator Knezik is a Marine Corps veteran, and he had two friends that when he came back from serving in combat, he had two friends that took their own lives. And it's been a very personal story and journey for him. And we thought, you know, we really need to raise awareness about some of the issues that veterans face when they come back. So here we're specifically trying to highlight traumatic brain injuries, but also post-traumatic stress. There's a lot of veterans who have no idea that they may have a traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress. And we want to first raise awareness about the issues, and then second, say there is a way to get assessed and to be treated. But really, it's raising the awareness so that veterans know, you know what, maybe you do need to get assessed. Maybe there is something that is wrong, and we can help you, you know, get on the path to treatment.
What we've seen in the Middle East is not our first brush with war and combat. Do you think as a society we're just becoming more aware of the mental toll that war takes on people? Have we just become more cognizant of it, or is this more pronounced in these particular conflicts?
I think we've definitely become more aware, and you also combine it with we have the lowest mortality rate that we've ever had when it comes to wars. You know, here in Michigan, we've had Travis Mills, who's a quadruple amputee. In previous wars, he never would have survived. And so what we have is people who are surviving catastrophic injuries that never would have survived before. So we have, first, more awareness, but second, people surviving in our wars that never would have before. So we're going to obviously have a lot more serious issues. You know, we often refer to these as invisible wounds or hidden wounds. And, you know, the person may look physically completely fine, but they're not fine. And I think we saw a lot of it starting to creep up in the Vietnam era. And a lot of times we just say, well, that person's different. And now we know it's not different isn't the word. They have a health issue and they need help. It's just that you can't see it because it's inside the brain.
In preparing for this event and in learning about it, what has struck you as far as learning something different or something new about the types of injuries that the folks are coming back from the Middle East with?
Well, I met with Eisenhower Center and some other healthcare providers who are on the east side, and it was incredible to see the cutting-edge technology that they can use to diagnose somebody with a traumatic brain injury who probably would have been missed before. And then they can actually retrain the brain to work around those damaged areas. So while they may not be able to completely reverse what had happened, other parts of the brain can be retrained to take on, you know, the jobs that the damaged part of the brain used to do. It is incredible, the technology that's out there. The frustrating part is the technology isn't necessarily in the VA where a lot of the healthcare is delivered. But we've got the private sector really doing cutting-edge technology. And how can we raise awareness so that the VA benefits can include these great services that can truly be a difference maker in veterans' lives?
I ran into Senator Kinesic on the floor last week. I saw him in a boot, unfortunately. It looks like he may be out as far as the marathon's concerned.
Well, you know, it's going to be a day of decisions. Senator Kinesic's heart is so in this marathon. He injured himself about 2 weeks ago on a run. He has 3 stress fractures and a bad sprain. And while the medical diagnosis says he won't run on marathon day, it's going to be a day of decision. He's working hard, trying to heal himself. It's an uphill battle. And so we're going to make that call the day of. And if he doesn't run it, he is going to be there, total support and spirit. He has trained so hard for this event, and any prayers that people have for miraculous healing, that is what we're looking for, because his heart's really in this, and it would be nice to be able to see him do the run.
And as you mentioned, this is very personal for him, and obviously something that he wants to do to show his support for those who have fallen and who are now injured and back in society here back in their home country. So, well, that's a great story. And just switching gears here a second, you had a couple bills that passed this past week that had to do with bicycles and drivers actually paying attention and staying away from them as they're going down the road. Those passed pretty unanimously. You pretty happy with what happened there?
I am. There are 5 bills, and we moved 3 of them forward. There's 2 that some good points were made about some fixes that we need. So 2 of the bills, which are about actual criminal penalties for hitting a vulnerable roadway user, we're continuing to work on those. We're going to tackle those from a different angle, still get to the same outcome. But I'm so glad that early in the process, a problem was raised so we can address that. But the 3 bills that moved, first, you know, 2 of the bills dealt with a 5-foot passing distance, because it really is important that, just like we do for police officers, that we move away from the police officer, it's important that we get away from the vulnerable roadway user, the bicyclist, the pedestrian. so that we have a safe passing distance. The other bill, the third bill that passed, was teaching in driver's education, what are the rules when you're riding a bicycle, or the laws when you're riding a bicycle? What are the laws when you're a pedestrian? What are the laws about when you're a driver and you're going by a vulnerable roadway user? In driver's education, we're just not seeing a consistency of it being taught. And it's really important that we talk about this, because after the tragedy in my community, I had my young drivers telling me, I was never taught in driver's education that bicyclists can use the roadway and they actually have laws to follow. And it's very important that we teach people when they're absorbing everything about how to drive safely on the road.
Well, it's funny you mention that. I can't tell you how many times I've been on the road and biking and drivers going by telling me I'm supposed to be riding my bike on the sidewalk, screaming at me like I'm supposed to be riding on the sidewalk.
You know, for serious cyclists and runners, a lot of people don't understand the road is actually a preferred area. For bicyclists, obviously, it's much safer because you're not having to deal with cars backing out of driveways that aren't seeing you, or dealing with slow moving traffic on the sidewalk. So many drivers have no idea that for serious cyclists, the roadway is the safest place to be. And for runners, I mean, Kyle, you're a runner. You just ran the Detroit Marathon. You know that the sidewalks can really beat up the legs. If you're running all your training runs on sidewalks, and you've got the curb cuts in between all the driveways, you get some ups and downs, you've got to deal with cars as well who don't pay attention to the sidewalk when they back out. And so often it's a much safer environment for serious runners and cyclists to be on the road. And people have no understanding. You wouldn't unless you've done it. So if we want to continue to promote healthy communities, we need to raise awareness. And the biggest thing we need to let the drivers know is you do have to share the roadway with cyclists. And I'm not sure where so much anger has come from drivers towards cyclists, but it does frighten me.
Yeah, and it does frighten me too. In fact, when I run, and you're right, I don't like to ride on the or run on the sidewalks. And some of it is because I agree with Virg Monero. He said our sidewalks suck here in the city of Lansing. He did use the word suck, and I would concur with that. A lot of it, though, too, is we've had trees planted so close to the sidewalks that they just completely chew them up here in the neighborhoods. And I end up staring at my feet half the time, making sure I don't trip over something. But the other thing is, yeah, I quit running with music because I've gotten so concerned about drivers not paying attention or not looking out for me or being ambivalent to me running on the road. And I just got to have all five senses aware at all times, and to have headphones in and have that distraction. I'm just concerned for my personal safety to have them in anymore.
You know, I've had a number of my bicycling friends who have had cars that have come intentionally too close. It wasn't an accident. There are some who've been hit by a car, and it seems common in the bicycling world to be hit by a car. Fortunately, most of the time, it's not super serious. I stopped or tried to stop running on roads for a significant portion because I had a car that threw firecrackers at me, one that threw a broken bottle. Cars,
oh my God.
Acted like they were going to try and hit me, even though I was off on the gravel. I wasn't even on the road. You know, when I see a car coming, I'll jump in the grass. I'll do anything to not impede the vehicle's path, but they will just gun for you. And it's like you mentioned, it's been frightening training for the marathon, having to go back to road running, because when you're doing a four-hour run or a three-hour run, part of your run is still dark and you've got to run on the road. I can't run on the trail system, and there's a limit of how far you can run on sidewalks. And so I get into some of my areas, some of my neighborhoods that don't have sidewalks. And even though it's slower moving traffic, it's frightening to see how many people aren't paying attention, even though I've got a flashing light on me to show. And even in daylight, they're just not paying attention. In daylight, I have a few more options with trails. But it is very challenging, and we want to have healthy people. We want to have healthy communities. That means we've got to be willing, as people who are driving vehicles, we got to make sure that we are showing respect for that vehicle. That vehicle can kill, and we need to handle it appropriately. And we need to be looking out for those vulnerable roadway users who are just trying to get to work, get to class, or live a healthy lifestyle.
Senator Margaret O'Brien, she is from the 20th District in Kalamazoo and Portage. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. All right, guys, we've got the predictions on the board here. I was on the radio this morning being the boldest here with a 63-6 pasting for Michigan. Jack, you weren't as aggressive on that pick here.
No, I wasn't as aggressive. What was your pick?
63-6. I think they can get a couple field goals.
I think Michigan is probably gonna have a good game, but I still, as a Michigan fan, worry that they've had things too easy so far, and I do worry about their heads being a little bit blown up. I actually like the fact that Ohio State got upset by Penn State this week more because I don't really care in terms of them losing, other than that it could be used as a warning to Michigan. The coaches at Michigan can say, hey, look, it happened to Ohio State. We better be ready when we go into East Lansing.
That said, he did pick 41-3, Jacob. That's and he's concerned that they're going to be coming into the game big-headed, and he says 41-3. You were in that same ballpark, though.
Man, I was comfortable picking my U of M win, but now I'm embarrassed to be selling out MSU to our larger audience. But I realized our scoring.
You can use my lunchbox if you want.
Well, the way we're scoring the points here so we can win, I bowed to the competition. So I picked U of M 35-10. My optimism is very low, but I'm hoping to prepare for an MSU victory. But if not, hoping to win this little competition here. 35-10, Big Ten-esque score.
Abby's not watched a football game all year, but that usually means that she's going to win. 42-22, Abby?
Yeah, I should say, much unlike Jack, being the blue dot in a sea of green has sort of forced me into a state of hiatus. I don't really watch football that much anymore. I also get a lot of naysayers like Simon here who point out that I did not go to the fine University of Michigan. So, I haven't watched football in a while, and I've also been scared a little bit by U of M in the past, so I let MSU have a couple of touchdowns.
All right, Simon, good for you. Somebody had to pick State.
It's true. I mean, Kyle, attitude is everything, and on a sober level, whether I think or not, whether or not I think MSU is actually going to win this game, I think is irrelevant. I think that this team and D'Antonio's players play best when they have a big chip on their shoulder, but if they go into this game with a defeatist attitude, I think we've already lost. So, I have them up by 3 points.
All right, what's your score, Simon?
I have MSU winning 24-21.
All right. Simon is the true MSU fan.
Look at that. Getting into the psychology of football, Simon Schuster. He's going to have the book out for Christmas just in time so you can give to your loved ones. That's going to do it for this week. We're taking pre-orders now. Simon Schuster, he's already got the publishing company taken care of.
For the record, I know by far the least about football of anyone at this table.
And that's what makes you the most qualified to write about it. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care. Life was easy when I was young, young, young.